This is a show called Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show, please email me at talk@mysticpete.com. We start the show today with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Boom. Then I have an interview with Alea Aquarian. Then songs by Thrill You Kill You, Luna Ray, Candy Bomber, and Mari and Polo Yazaki. And wrap it up with some stories by me, Mystic Pete. Stay tuned.
In 1966, it dawned on about 100 Willingham High School juniors that if they were going to go to college, they had to take a science class in their senior year. Now, all of us had taken biology taught by Mr. Robert Floyd, a former professional wrestler turned Baptist minister. If you don't think his explanation about the birds and the bees wasn't interesting, guess again. We needed another science class to get into college. The smarter students, the one that knew all along that they were going to go to college, had taken chemistry and or physics taught by Mr. Pridgeon. These boys were the Beta Club members, the members of the student government. These were the boys that cared. The group of boys I was a part of were bumping into life. We were slackers before there was a title for us. High school, for us, was something to be survived. The less effort, the better. Life has a habit of slapping you in the face. High school was ending, and we were one science credit short of having the requirements needed to get into any college. We were not smart enough to get into Mr. Pridgeon's classes, nor was there enough room for us. The school took pity on us low achievers and created a class called Physical Science. Physical science was basically a BS class that was made up just so we could get a science credit and maybe go to college. It was 1966 and the Vietnam War was raging. If you were in college, you could get a college deferment. If you were not in college, Mrs. Beasley from the Bibb County Selective Service Board would be calling on you. You would likely be drafted and sent to the war. There was a lot of interest in going to college in 1966. I still carry my draft card in my wallet as a reminder of those that went to war and did not return, or returned carrying wounds, both physical and mental. The school hired a young man named George Carswell to teach this group of slackers. Carswell had just graduated from Georgia Tech and enlisted in the armed forces through a program called Deferred Enlisting. This means he was going into the Army Officer Candidate School, but not until January of 1967. This was the Army's method of just-in-time inventory control. This poor guy got the job of teaching these students for the first half of the school year, and then, as a Christmas bonus, he goes off to OCS and then off to Vietnam. Carswell was only 3 years older than the students. He had no control over the classroom at all. None. He could not turn his back to the classroom to write on the blackboard without getting hit by a spitball fired from a straw or a projectile sent by a rubber band hurtling his way. After 3 weeks, he had become very adept at writing on the blackboard without turning his back to the class. The classroom was the normal rectangular-shaped box painted pale green with 35 students' desks divided into rows. The teacher had a desk up front, and there was the requisite blackboard. Along the south wall of the classroom were windows from a waist height to the ceiling. Also along this wall was a heater for the room. This classroom environment in which an M80 was introduced. For those of you not familiar with an M80, it is a type of powerful firework that has been used over the years for all sorts of destructive things. It's a red cardboard tube about 1.5 inches long and 3/4 inch around. There's a fuse in the middle of the tube and about 3 grams of gunpowder inside. It is powerful enough that if you should not happen to release it in time, you will lose a finger or two. An M80 is also known in the fireworks trade as a salute because it makes a lot of noise when it explodes. My friend Mike Wilkerson brought this M80 to school and showed it to me. We cooked up the idea of setting the M80 off in Mr. Carswell's classroom. In that Mr. Carswell was going to be sent to Vietnam, we felt it our duty to get him accustomed to unexpected explosions. It seemed like the right thing to do for 2 17-year-olds. We stuck the fuse of the M80 into a lit cigarette, thereby giving a delayed ignition to the fuse. We were early getting into Mr. Carswell's classroom. There was a desk in the back of the room that did not have a back on it for some reason. This was a safe place for us to put the delayed action bomb. No one would be seated at this desk, we hoped. The M80 with cigarette ignition was in place, and the rest of the class filed in, sat down, and class started. As always, the class was riveted on every word that Carswell had to say. Not. Most of the class was daydreaming, sleeping, or doing homework for some other class that mattered, and nothing happened. 10 minutes went by, and nothing happened. 15 minutes went by, and nothing happened. Mike and I kept looking at each other across the classroom. 20 minutes went by, and nothing happened. At this point, I assumed that the cigarette had gone out, so I joined the rest of the class in not paying attention. Light travels faster than sound. The first indication of ignition of the M80 was a rather bright flash that illuminated the entire classroom. It was like a lightning strike or a photographer's strobe light. This was followed almost immediately by an earache-inducing boom. An M80 emits a great deal of smoke upon explosion. The resulting smoke was billowing up toward the ceiling in a mini-mushroom-shaped cloud. I can assure you, anyone that had been sleeping in class was now fully awake, alert, and headed to the door to the hallway with the rest of the classroom. I think Mr. Carswell was first through the door. I do remember seeing him as white as a sheet. I doubt he made a good combat officer in Vietnam. I don't think he could take the stress of combat. He certainly was not cut out to command an artillery battalion. The explosion dislodged all of the dust that had accumulated over the years on top of the fluorescent light fixtures in the classroom. The M80 created a blizzard of dust. The light fixtures themselves were swaying back and forth like they do in a cheap Roger Corman horror movie. I tell you, it was a sight to see. The desk was made out of metal in the front, back, bottom, and one side. The seat was plywood. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. I may not have been in Mr. Pridgen's physics class, but this experiment in Mr. Carswell's class proved this law of physics. After the explosion, the desk, which had been in the second row, was now in the third row, resting on its side, smoking. The front, back, bottom, and one side of the desk were bowed out as if an elephant had sat on the desk. The plywood seat had been split through in a manner that produced hundreds of splinters. Thank God no one was seated in this desk. He would have been still picking splinters out of his butt today. Once outside, Wilkerson and I made a pact not to tell a soul about what we had done. Not a soul. We knew that if we told anyone, the news would spread over the campus and we would be up the creek. Some rat would turn us in. All of the teachers in this wing of the school showed up almost immediately. Mr. Johnson, the principal, was there shortly after. He was pissed, really pissed. He called the police and the fire department. Who knew Macon had a bomb squad in 1966? We were saved by the fact that we did this on a Friday and the following Monday was a holiday. After 3 days, the immediacy of the bombing had died down. The desk itself was removed by the fire department for study. A.R. Willingham High School for Boys has long been demolished. I'm going back there soon for a class reunion. I think I will go by the site and see if there is a dent in the ground from that M80 explosion.
Mystic Pete here. It is July 30th, 2020. I have on the phone Alea Aquarian, who I've known for years and years, and she has a very interesting story that I feel bridges a couple of eras, and I think this interview may connect some civilization dots. Hi, Alea.
Hi, Peter. It's so good to talk to you.
Yes, yes. Well, why don't you explain a little about who you are and your name, and we'll go from there.
Yes, absolutely. So my name, Alea Amanita Aquarian. I'll start with the last name. My dad was in the spiritual brotherhood called the Source Family in the 70s, and they all were given spiritual names, and they all took the last name Aquarian. And so my dad legally changed his name, and when he met my mom, he was Zarathustra Aquarian. He had just left the family when he met my mom, so they all moved to Hawaii at a certain point, and he didn't go with them, and then he was continuing to live in L.A., doing different kinds of spiritual study, and my mom had just graduated from chiropractic school, and she was on her path of learning about spirituality. So they met at a Fourth Way Gurdjieff meeting at a vegetarian restaurant in Venice Beach, where they would meet at 4 o'clock in the morning and do Fourth Way stuff, have conversations and stuff like that. And so they got together, and then in January of 1979, they took mushrooms and had a conscious conception where they, my mom says she knew the moment that I was
incarnated.
Yeah, that I started to come in, or I guess, well, what they say is that actually it's like 3 or 4 months before is when the soul kind of chooses its life to come into. They had sex and they had me, and then because they were on mushrooms when they conceived me, they gave me the middle name Amanita, which is after the Amanita muscaria, the most powerful psychedelic mushroom. And then my first name, to finish up this story about my name, is Alea, which they saw the first Star Trek movie that had this bald character named Alea, and she joined her consciousness with the V'ger, which was like an AI that had gone into space and developed sentient consciousness.
Yes, V'ger. Voyager, right.
And was going to... It was going to destroy the universe.
Good movie. And that's where your name comes from.
Right, yeah. That was what my name came from, my first name, the idea for my first name.
Wow, okay. Interview over.
People, no pressure there.
Well, so let me just inject a little bit of theory I have. I see a lot of the most progressive ideas happening today, all starting in the 60s and all coming out of this era. I mean, whether you consider healthy foods, brown rice, meditation, getting back to nature, crafts, you know, encounter sessions, love-ins, all this stuff, and treating children beautifully and respectfully, this all started basically with the hippies. And I don't know that it's really been recognized. Like, the scientists are coming along and they go, well, yes, tofu and brown rice are good for you. You know, like, it's finally legitimate. But this explosion of consciousness happened in the 1960s and 1970s with people like your parents and you. And now, the next generation, it's matured. Now, back then, this was pioneering energy, and with any pioneering group, there's casualties. You know, there were all kinds of drug abuse and all kinds of people getting hurt in a lot of ways, but people were feeling their way through all of this new stuff. But now we're matured and we've grown up and, you know, legit people in the world and made sense of it more, but we still have the kernels of that consciousness now at a higher octave. And that's somebody, I see you as somebody that is able to do that. You started with this very important revelation of civilization back then, and you've had to make something of it and make something of yourself. And I know you're an artist and very involved in consciousness and politics and philosophy and writing. So now let's talk. Move it up to now. And yeah, how have you made sense of it all?
I guess throughout my life, I've always considered myself a performer. I used to think I was an actress and wanted to be in theater, classical, you know, kind of theater and film and television. Then when I went to college, I got a little bit disillusioned about it. I realized that being a part of the system, you know, like a cog in the system, you know, working in the industry was not attractive to me. So I stopped pursuing performing for a while. And then I went to Burning Man, which was something I remember you talking about back in the day. So it was one of those things that seed was planted. And once I went there, I saw the psychedelic community and the circus community. And I said, oh, those are my people.
Uh-huh.
That's where I belong. So at that point, I started developing this character called Psychodelicate. And she's an interdimensional traveler, psychedelic clown. And where I'm coming from with what I'm creating with her is sharing a lot of the spiritual ideas that I was raised with. You know, I grew up going to this temple called the Builders of the Adytum, and it's Western Mysteries, Kabbalah, and Tarot, and that was one of the teaching, like, that lineage, that was, like, someone who married, they were, like, the officiant for the marriage of Yehoah, Jim Baker, Father Yod, from the Source family, to at least one of his 14 wives.
B-O-T-A. And, yeah, so the leader of the commune, cult, collective, whatever it is that your parents were once a part of.
My dad, uh-huh.
Yeah, so he was influenced by the Builders of the Adytum.
Right.
Got it. And you attended some of these lectures, and they influenced you, and, you know, some kind of sincerely mystical group, I would have to say.
Yes, yes, very much so. Yeah, and so, I grew up sitting in the back and absorbing all of this. And one of the things that I think is worth mentioning about from that standpoint of what you're talking about, like, what is it that we are left with from the impact of, you know, the 60s and the revolution that was happening, or the evolution that was happening in the 60s and the 70s. It's this idea that entering into the Aquarian age, and like the truth is being revealed, and there's this kind of looking at all of the different traditions of the world, you know, the different spiritual practices and religions, and really coming to this place of, you know, a more scientific inquiry, that we're, you know, like all these things like meditation and yoga and stuff like that, where there are these ancient teachings that have been, you know, brought to the West that people are exploring now.
Oh yeah, those are some other things that started back then I forgot to mention. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, totally. And so what I wanted to say about this is that I grew up with these teachings, these Western mystery teachings, but it's also like I grew up with a lot of, I've also Self-Realization Fellowship, Rosicrucians, you know, even my mom went to like a Lutheran Foursquare church, like all these, you know, I was really exposed, and Judaism, my sister converted to Judaism. I'm so grateful to be in this place where I've been able to experience so many different traditions and thoughts, you know, ways of thinking about life and spirituality, where I see the evolution of from what's happened in the 60s and 70s to what's happening now, is this like really exploring and inquiring about the truth for ourselves, you know, that we are moving into this Aquarian age where we just take things at face value and follow blindly kind of stuff. It's really about learning for ourselves. And so that's, I want to bring these ideas, because I see value in them, from learning for myself what makes sense and finding my own truth through all these different types of belief systems.
And you were saying that you have three principles: intentional, community. Why don't you say it?
Yeah, well, so there's three main projects that I'm working on right now, and I'm wrapping them all up into a little bow of a podcast that I'm going to be starting. And I want to talk about these things that I think are basically are critical to our zeitgeist. You know, like this is the stuff that, for me, will make a difference in the world if people are thinking about it. The first one that I've been talking about is psychedelicate, and I'll just share the mission statement for what I do. Psychedelicate is here now to spread the good news of the multiverse, opening hearts and expanding minds through interdimensional travel, demonstration, and practicum.
Quite a mouthful.
And what's that?
A mouthful. Good. We're with you.
It's a big mission. So I'm using different kind of mystery teachings and ontology, the study of being, and you know, kind of like the Socratic method, the practice of inquiry. All to create edutainment experiences where people kind of can get pushed out of their comfort zone a little bit, have new experiences. I got, you know, a lot of great reviews when I did the Fringe Festival, where people said, you know, they felt like they were at Burning Man, they felt like they were, you know, not so weird, you know, like they felt at home, they felt like they could be themselves. Also a lot about psychedelic integration and seeing, you know, the substances that we have that alter our brain chemistry, to recognize the power of the tools that they are, to, you know, to not just vilify them or even just use them as escape, but to really use them to discover who we are and why we're here. And, you know, they have so much healing medicinal power to give us these new experiences of awareness of self, like the small self and the larger self.
Well, so very, very interesting point you make. And let me just interject that I think we're at a point of humanity where everything is crumbling. I mean, economically, socially, just everything is falling to earth. All the structures are, there's a reset button being hit. And I think people go, well, you know, we could just get over this and go back to the way it was last year or 6 months ago. I don't think that is going to happen. I think the hole that we're going to be in soon, or that we're in that we don't even realize, is very deep. And I think the answers are going to require some real wholesale reassessment of self. Now, I'm not saying the answers come from builders of the Adytum or mysticism or Burning Man or tofu or the arts or tribalism. I mean, or maybe it comes from all of it. But I think we actually have to look at basic assumptions of what we are and of humanity to really figure out where to go in the future. It's just not like a spackle job we could just put on top of this after the pandemic goes away. No, we have to go much, much deeper. And I guess my point was that answer started in the 60s and 70s. And certainly psychedelics have a big influence because people who take them say that it entirely takes you out of a normal consciousness. And you see your life, you see the world, you see reality from a whole new perspective. And you're talking about psychedelics. And, you know, I'm not encouraging anybody, but I think it's an important part of the conversation because it's really influenced a lot of people. And it's part of this wholesale re-evaluation of self and society. Anyway, so that's catching up. My point is we really have to dig very deep now to figure out how to move on into the future, merely to survive. But so let's just talk about psychedelics for one more minute. And, you know, I know people talk now about microdosing and, you know, this whole church is now set up for ayahuasca. And, you know, there's kind of the light and dark of it. But it sounds like this is a very important experience to you. And it sounds like you feel like it is for culture.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because of my background being conceived on mushrooms and having that be kind of part of my origin story of my life.
You know, that's what it is. And probably a lot of people have that story, right? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's funny. That's something that I've been wanting to explore. I've been meaning to kind of reach out to the world and see who else has this experience, because I do know of at least one other person, Terrence McKenna's son, I know, was conceived on mushrooms. I've heard that.
Terrence McKenna.
Story from, of course, it's pretty logical that that would be the case, but
okay, I hung out in a hot tub with Terrence McKenna naked in Esalen. Okay, just I wanted to get in my bona fides. Go ahead.
It's your bona fide Terrence McKenna story.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's one other thing that I've recently been reminded of, and you know, I was very blessed to grow up here in Los Angeles. When I was a small baby, my parents were going and hanging out with John Lilly and
other pioneers of consciousness. Yes.
Right. Exactly. And then like we hung out with Manly P. Hall and he
Philosophical Research Center in Pasadena. Okay.
Yeah.
You got some more cred than I do. Okay. Okay. LA. I know where this is going.
Well, yeah. I mean, so yeah, I am pretty clear that I really, you know, I came in with this volition, you can call it, you know.
Well, you're like a bridge. Well, so let's wind up with just moving into the future now. You as an artist, it sounds like And I think this is true for many people who are pioneers of consciousness, that they find the arts as a very accessible vehicle to breathe themselves into, that people will respond to, and they can be heard and seen and perhaps make a living. So tell me about yourself as an artist and how you see yourself emerging and drawing this immense background and this mosaic of pieces all into something, well, kind of entertaining and fun.
Yes, so there's psychedelic, it's magical playtime, which is teaching life tools, you know, inquiry tools through the lens of interdimensional travel, supporting humanity and taking action around the climate crisis and, you know, what happens to civilization and humanity during this, you know, some people like to call it ascension, this, you know, the new age. And that's very much like what Psychedelic It's Magical Playtime is about, is I took it from Robert Anton Wilson, but I love the term immanentizing the eschaton.
Wow. The last thing.
Say that again.
Eschaton, that's the last thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, getting people excited about the end times and what is the new world that we want to create. And so, with the Community Explorer, I'm looking at sharing tools about how intentional communities are an access to that, creating a world of harmony and compassion and workability, where we're not destroying each other and the planet. And then the Ontological Detective Agency is an open source platform for tools of interpersonal growth and development. So, you know, all things like nonviolent communication. I love, like, I really want to share, I'm always sharing Byron Katie's The Work, things that help us to be human beings that are able to be as kind and good to each other and the planet as possible.
Well, I think where we could leave it is with the question, is the world about to end or is the world about to begin? And I would have to call myself an apocaloptimist. And Alea Aquarian, we are looking forward to great emanations coming from you. And we'll be watching for you.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to jump out onto the scene a little bit more every day and share the good news of the multiverse.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That was an interview with Alea Aquarian. And now we hear the following songs. Ping Pong by Thrill You Kill You, just releasing. Big Escape by Luna Ray. Candy Bomber, Make My Story. And Teru Teru by Mari and Polo Yazaki.
2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? I know I wanna be somebody. And I know I wanna be with you too. So will you come on the playground with me? I don't know what you think you're made of. I know I wanna just be a fan.
times.
I know what I have to do now. It's my life,
one and only.
Follow my way.
悔しさまで連れて
Follow my way.
さらに先を目指す Hey boy, より感動を犯して夢見たい
I know what I have to do now.
こんなにたくさんの人生がある中で 正解を見つけた Make my story. 頬をぶたれてきた
Have it your way.
ここまでの復讐は
Have it your way.
君には分からない 成功より実際は失敗を連れてきて
I know what I have to do now.
こんなに限界を追い越すと決めても ダメだった日々も Make my story. 日々が待つことだけ見てるこんなにたくさんの人生がある中で 世界は自分で見つけた Make my story.
Now a few short stories that I wrote. Conversation over. There are people who don't detect or simply ignore the conversation over vocal cue. On the phone, there's a well-known, "we're wrapping up now," tone in one person's voice that the other is expected to recognize. Once that tone is uttered, that's all, folks. If social conventions are kept, the receiver of the tone is supposed to help move the conversation towards conclusion. Goodbye.
Bye.
But some people are pretty thick and go into an additional loop of conversation. With the densest, who continue with loop after loop, you have to engage some pretty militant salutations.
Gotta go! My cat is on fire!
Click. Then there's the clueless in-person conversation never-enders. If you walk with me down my hill to the beach someday, you may witness the following. My neighbor, Eve, is almost always on her balcony wanting to chat. I usually put on my best, "gotta get down to the beach to do something important," stride, so to discourage chit-chat. But every once in a while I weaken and be civil. Eve talks and talks, trying to convince me to try her latest amazing health regimen that made her feel better than ever. Recovering cancer patient that she is, as up there on the balcony, she chain smokes. Eve goes on and on about her problems and how everyone is doing her wrong. Though after about 5 minutes, I've had it, and I give her the gotta go tone of voice. Always ignored, I start backing away down the hill. Ever have someone continue a discussion, yelling, with you now over 10 feet away? How about 20 feet? Two-faced. I've been on both sides of the authority divide, but either way, two-facedness never fails to leave me feeling miffed. On the authority side, when I have opportunity for others, like being able to put someone on radio or give them a nice paying gig, people adopt this interested tone of voice and present pleasant smiles to me. I think they are being friendly, or simply like me. I generally assume that the way people act towards me has some authenticity. But after the opportunity is passed, the gig is over, or they get the pair of tickets they wanted to the Las Palmas, their voice may newly have sounds of disinterest, and I see a face with no more smiles. It's all a put-on, and it leaves me upset that friendliness is used so casually as a commodity. Question: was the Las Palmas show really worth the loss of your dignity? As a tyke, I experienced two-facedness for the first time in elementary school, on the underside of the authority divide in Mean Mrs. Lewis's class. She was known for repeatedly slamming a wooden ruler against her desk when angry, which was often. She never cursed, but the one time she really lost it, she swore out the word, "balls!" The students did their best not to chuckle at her tantrum, lest they become victims of her wrath. The disconnect came on parent-teacher night, when all through the evening, Mrs. Lewis dripped with charm and graciousness, brimming with compliments and kind words. It was nice to see her so nice, and for a moment we were all buddies. Maybe things would be different after that. But I had some psychic whiplash the next day when she was back to being a turd. "Mrs. Lewis, couldn't you have made the effort to treat your students kindly and to always be gracious to your young charges, so in need of care, rather than merely putting on a show of it to the parents once a semester?" By the way, just so it's mentioned, I've had a lot of kind teachers too. My pal Joe had a dad who was sour. The only sound that came out of him was barking. Barking at Joe, barking at his wife, and barking at the radio as sportscasters announced baseball games. Joe's dad once came to my house to try to sell my dad insurance. There in the living room, Joe's dad was trying to make a sale with cooing and giggling and honeyed tones and treating me like a champ. Joe's dad, grumpy guy without a name. How does it feel, decades after you left this world, that the one time you are mentioned on radio, you are being remembered as two-faced? Why aren't these people embarrassed by the lie they are so shamelessly presenting? To them, perhaps it's only in front of people they won't know for long, or to underlings or inferiors. However, neighbors will still be living down your block tomorrow. The supervised become supervisors, and citizens eventually take charge. Also, kids grow up to be influential media personalities, and we don't forget. A radio first. What I have to say now probably has never been discussed. I'm certain it has never been mentioned on radio. I wanted to do a radio first, so I'll be remembered for something in this world. I'm going to be the first person on planet Earth to discuss, on air, avocado slicing. How do you prepare avocados? Do you first have the avocado, then peel, and then take out the seed? Or first have, then take out the seed, and finally peel? Perhaps you slice it in half with the skin on, and then scoop out the meat from each avocado half with a spoon. Or, and this is something I've never done, first peel the whole thing, then have it, and lastly, pull out the seed. Well, that's it. A radio first. Words that mean nothing. Years ago, just for fun, I came up with a meaningless phrase, which is pretty something. As in, what do you think of my electro-goth punk mix? Well, it's pretty something. Curiously, pretty something sounds like a substantial enough response that nobody's called me out with, yeah, that means nothing. I was so happy about this empty verbal creation, which sounded significant, that I started using it regularly. But I've used it so much by now that its meaninglessness has evolved, and now it has found meaning. It sounds like I'm saying, well done, even to me. Now, that's pretty something. I think my favorite phrase that means nothing was uttered by my 8-year-old neighbor a while back when I was hanging with his family watching the Lakers play, and they were losing. I said to the young fellow, what advice do you have for the purple and gold? He took a moment, looked deeply into my eyes, and with earnestness said, they have to play like they want to win. I was speechless. I never heard something so beautiful. It sounded so wise and insightful, but frankly, it was completely bereft of meaning. Do any professional sports teams, really, does anyone play sports ever like they don't want to win? Isn't that something every athlete does, play like they want to win? If you'd ever like to make an intelligent-sounding comment about a sport, you may even say this if you know nothing about the game. Say, they have to play like they want to win. Everyone will nod in agreement and respect you for your wisdom. I'm reminded of the very first radio interview I did for my book on mysticism. It was over the phone, and after answering the host's questions, she played a song before going to the break, which she herself had wrote and recorded. Frankly, it was the worst song I ever heard played on radio. And after the break, she asked me what I thought of the song. I was on the spot. I searched my internal list of meaningless phrases that I keep handy and replied with, "People really feel the emotion in your music." She said, "Thank you. But did you like it?" Sweating now, on live radio, I mean, I didn't want to sound like an idiot for praising something that was clearly awful, but I also didn't want to publicly insult her, so I said, "It's a really interesting song." Again from her, "Thanks." She paused, sensing I still hadn't answered her question. Then, "But did you like it?" Digging deeply into my reserve of non-answers, I pulled out my last option, hoping this public torture would end here. "You know, you put your heart into that tune." Mercifully, we moved back to the interview about my fascinating book. You've been listening to the Mystic Pete Chronicles. We started the show with a story by Mike Bone called Boom. Then I interviewed Alea Aquarian. Then we heard Ping Pong by Thrill You Kill You. Then Big Escape by Luna Ray. Then Make My Story by Candy Bomber. And Teru Teru by Mari and Polo Yazaki. Then four short stories by me, Mystic Pete. If you'd like more information about the show, or perhaps to be interviewed yourself on radio, you can find me at mysticpete.com. Thanks so much for listening. Mystic Pete out!